Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Every once in a while, you get lucky. Recently, I got lucky when former NFL offensive lineman Steve Wright contacted me. He played for the Cowboys, the Colts, and the Raiders, spent some time in the USFL. He played with and against some of the greatest to ever put on a pair of cleats in the NFL. And his life off the field, well, about as colorful as you can get. And we are going to discuss so much of it next on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shape the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. Today, a little departure from going way back in time to cover the stars of yesteryear and the teams that long ago closed up shop. Today, we are going to talk with former NFL offensive lineman Steve Wright. His story is fascinating and, like I said, a slight departure from what I normally talk about. Steve had a good career, a really good career. He played for the Cowboys, the Colts, and the Raiders. He spent some time in the USFL with the Oakland Invaders as well. And while he might not be the kind of player you would categorize as a forgotten hero, he certainly made an impact on the game. He was a part of three historic events, contributed to the game in a most significant way by bringing a unique innovation that started in the NFL and has spread throughout several sports and everyday life as well. And his off-the-field antics, well, they are the type of stuff that Hollywood producers love. Speaking of love, he found the perfect match well after his playing days as well. Yes, Steve's story is a fascinating and entertaining one, and I am so happy he will be joining us on today's show. A little housekeeping first. Please give Sports Forgotten Heroes a follow on X, you know, formerly Twitter. I am really looking to build that community. You can find Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes or on X at SportsFHeroes. Every day I post about the show and give you even more information about my guests and topics. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Facebook and now you can watch on YouTube as well at Sports Forgotten Heroes. And as always, if you can, please leave a nice review wherever you listen and a like if you can find the time as well. And as always, thank you for your support. Okay, back to today's show, Steve Wright. He broke into the NFL as an undrafted free agent with the Dallas Cowboys in 1981. His career, including his two seasons in the USFL, lasted 12 years. That's pretty darn good for an offensive lineman, especially for one who has led such a colorful life off the field that included women, parties, a Playboy bunny, and a whole lot more. But after his days wound down, his life changed. It transformed. No way would you think the Steve Wright of today is the same Steve Wright who led that colorful life so many years ago. So let's get into it now with my special guest, Steve Wright. Steve, welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes. I am thrilled you are here.
And I am as well. Warren, thank you for having me. Sports Forgotten Heroes. I'm not sure about a hero, but maybe an old sports guy, and I got a lot of stories.
You do have a lot of stories. And, you know, it's not often I discuss the career and life of a former NFL offensive lineman. The position that you played doesn't really lend itself to recalling something so spectacular, right? But this opportunity to bring you on the show was something I just couldn't pass up. From your days with the Cowboys, Tom Landry, teammates like Ed Too Tall Jones, yeah, and Tony Dorsett, Harvey Martin, Randy White, Drew Pearson, to your days with the Colts and the detour you took to the Oakland Invaders and then back to the Raiders and Al Davis, plus your life off the field. Wow, Steve, you have certainly had a full life.
So I have.
Let's start there.
Okay.
I think you're just 64 years old.
Correct. Be 65 in April.
Okay. You have a ton of life left. But when you look back on where you've been and what you've done, do you ever think about how full a life you have lived?
Yeah. Thanks, Warren. Yeah, I do all the time. I actually pinch myself all the time. I have for decades that, like, you know, it's why me? You know, it's almost a little guilty of how have I been so fortunate to be born at this time, missing the draft, you know, for Vietnam and you know, living a pretty nice lifestyle, fortunate to be raised in a loving family, you know, white collar, you know, middle class, middle to upper class. You know, I was super fortunate. There really hasn't been a lot of struggles in my life, that I'm so fortunate for. And that's why it really opens up my heart even more to do what I can. And I think I kind of explained that in the book. It's just, I've been a fortunate guy, and it's, I enjoy giving back and just, you know, helping others that didn't have the easy ride that I've been fortunate to have.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, you know, your life has certainly been a colorful one. And I encourage anybody who's listening or watching today's show to pick up a copy of Steve's book, Aggressively Human. We can never cover everything that's in there. And there is so much off the field that Steve has done. The stories are terrific, so entertaining. But this being Sports Forgotten Heroes, we will concentrate mostly on your career on the field.
Great.
And what I'd like to do is start with Northern Iowa. And admittedly, you reveal in your book that classes were somewhat of an afterthought. You didn't really go to college for school. You were there to play football. What point during your career in college at Northern Iowa did you think you might have what it takes to play in the NFL?
It was my junior year, and I received the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader calendar from the Cowboys, and it was, you know, how to hook a young kid. You know, and then along with the photos of the team photos. And then I just started receiving more letters directly, handwritten things, hand signed, from the Cowboys, along with a few other teams. But once the Cowboys reached out, you know, they were America's team. Everybody loved them. I grew up watching them in Minnesota, and I got a fun story in the book of watching Tony Dorsett and watching, Drew Pearson catch the Hail Mary. When I was in 10th grade, sitting outside freezing, and then 4 years later, I'm in a huddle with him in the exact same place in the dome in Minnesota, and Drew Pearson and I are high-fiving each other, and I'm just going like, what in the world? My life, I've been a fortunate guy and stayed healthy, and Yeah. So about my junior year, I was kind of hell bent on, okay, this is my path, because up to that point, I never even pictured it. All I wanted to do was be present. And I think that's another thing I kind of really try to share a lot in the book is being present. Because you might not be promised tomorrow, or you might not be on the team tomorrow, but sure. I'm on the team today. So I'm going to give it everything I have today, or, you know, the business or anything else, but really staying present. And so I was just being present at Northern Iowa, of just having fun and playing college football with my buddies and going out and, you know, gabbing turkeys and cow knocking over and out in the cow pastures and, you know, making your own fun there in Cedar Falls, Iowa. But then I started getting really serious and started putting the weight on and, and bringing the focus in to, man, I've got an opportunity. This is crazy. So go give it all.
What's it like, you know, you were drafted and you get a phone call from Tech Schramm? What is that like? I mean, you're like, who's playing a joke on me? Is this for real? What is that like?
Yeah, well, I was invited to training camp along with 120 other free agents. So I got a letter and showed up at training camp, and I had five other roommates. And over the course of the next 4 weeks, all five of them disappeared.
Wow.
Once you get cut, they'd knock on your door and say, everybody get up, get your playbooks. And, you know, Larry, go see Coach Landry. And you knew the guy was done. And he just would just disappear. So I spent the last, I don't know, week or two in my room by myself. And
wow.
Yeah, just trying to stay present and not let the boogeyman get into my mind. But yeah, there was like, I'm free to talk about it, but I was, you know, underneath my pillow with these guys, just, you know, crying, because I was just, it was so much pressure. And so three of us made it out of 120.
Wow.
Yeah. Myself and Everson Walls and Michael Downs. And it was the first time the Cowboys had ever kept 11 offensive linemen. And that same year, 1981, their number one and their number three draft picks were offensive linemen. Glenn Titan was number three and Howard Richards was number one. So there was no way in the world they were going to keep somebody else. But I hustled like nobody's ever hustled. And everybody says that, but I really did. It was like, I just called myself a wood tick. They couldn't get rid of me. They had to find a spot for me, and they knew it.
That's awesome. You know, one of the things you talk about in your book is the playbook. It's like a Bible, and you have this great story about an incident that one of your teammates had with the playbook and seeing it scattered all over the place. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was actually Glenn Titan. So I don't say the name in the book, but that was a third round draft pick. And he's the nicest guy, Mormon, just so straight arrowed, always doing everything by the book, no drinking, no swearing, just the best guy. And he was scrambling to work. And yeah, it was, the Cowboys were known for their scary playbook. Yeah, it was just, you know, a fat thing that you had to sleep with it. But he just left it on the top of his car, getting into his car one day to come over to practice, went through an intersection that slid off, and he came into practice and he couldn't find his playbook, and he traced it back. And there was papers shattered all over the intersection. He picked up what he could and got his ass chewed and never left it on the top of his car again.
Wow. But that was, I mean, that's got to be frightening, especially when you're a rookie trying to make the team and something like that happens. But now, it is.
If that would have been me, a free agent, I mean, they would have probably gotten rid of me. They got me for a bag of apples, you know. he was a third round draft pick. They had invested in him, but yeah. That would have been me.
Is it truly like, I mean, what, give us a little bit of color on the playbook. I mean, like you said, it's this thick. There's how do you study that? How do you learn that?
Yeah, well, it's just a kind of a page at a time, and you go over it with your offensive line coach and the linemen, and you know, they don't dump the whole thing at you. It's by chunks. You know, today we're going to learn, the first couple of days we're learning some just basic running plays and the holes, and and the defense, where the defense sets, are they in the three position, one position, what kind of, where the linebackers, and just kind of start getting acclimated that way. And then they bring in the passing plays and the sliding of the pass protection. Mm-hmm. But when you're a rookie, you know, it all becomes second nature once you've been playing for a while. But and at first, just the first page is scary because you can't make a mistake. You can't make a mistake, and you do, and you know, make amends for it and learn quick, or you're gone.
Well, jumping ahead just a little bit, one of your mentors or one of the coaches on the team who sort of took you under his wing was Mike Ditka. What was it like playing for Mike?
It was pretty tough to please him. But when you did, which I did a couple times, you know, just bear hug you and give you a love punch, you know, that would about knock anybody over. But he was brutal how he would get in guys' faces and you know, just melt their soul. It was just brutal. And for some reason, I don't know, maybe it was the hustle or the free agent thing. And he knew I was scrapping and everything else, but he'd come up and, you know, in training camp and I'm frustrated about something or other. Maybe my offensive line coach is yelling at me, right? God damn it. And just screaming at me. And he'd come up and he'd throw his arm around my neck and say, let's go for a walk. He'd say, he's driving you crazy, isn't he? He just keeps yelling at you. Steve, you got to realize you worry if he stops yelling at you. And I just went, whoa, you know, it's just a 180 life change. Like he cares.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or he pulled me off on another walk one time and because I got beat. And he said, Steve, everybody here is going to get beat. You're going to get your ass kicked. Deal with it. Figure it out fast. These mm-hmm. guys are getting paid too. So mm-hmm. you're not going to win everyone. You are going to get lambasted today. Figure it out and deal with it. And you're kind of going like, wow, there's a slap of reality. Okay. They know mm-hmm. I'm going to get beat. And mm-hmm. So, you know, figure it out.
And you did. Well, yeah. you played, I mean, Ditka took you under his wing like that, but the head coach of the team, probably one of the most, at least to us outsiders, one of the most stoic individuals to ever walk the sidelines of an NFL game, Tom mm-hmm. Landry. What was he like? And again, you relate a story that you found out that this guy who we all have this vision of as being, like I said, a stoic individual, a statue, tough man, was exchanging letters with your dad.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Handwritten letters. Yeah, that was pretty crazy. Really, really, really cool. Yeah, my dad just, you know, full of love for me and yeah, just writing back and forth. And then Coach Landry would write back to him a few times. But yeah, Landry was just, he would never raise his voice above what we're talking right now, no matter how mad he was at you. The joke, he always had a megaphone. And so he just turned the megaphone up a little louder and talked to you like that. But he was just, you know, somebody you just respected. And you know, it was amazing to start my NFL career with this guy instead of a guy like Frank Cush, who I talk about later.
Mm-hmm. But, yes.
You know, being under Tom Landry's tutelage and showing you how to act like a gentleman. We always dressed, no matter what, you always had a suit and tie on when you traveled. And the joke was, even if it was 10 o'clock at night and you had to run down the hall in the hotel to get a bucket of ice, you better have your coat and tie on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just everything on the plane. And you just didn't want to upset this guy. He was so brilliant. We'd start on Mondays and he'd just tell us a few things we got to get ready for this game. Don't worry about the rest. If we can get these third and longs down to third and short and blah, blah, blah. A couple of things. And I'd always check them. And it was always correct. He was a cool customer. I think I bummed him out a couple times being late as a rookie. And I think you read those stories. Oh my Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I'm honest, honestly, to this day, I still have nightmares probably once, at least once a week of being late to something. being late to get on the field. I can't find my helmet. I can't find my cleats or something like that. I'm running around in the locker room. These are real dreams I still have. I was so traumatized over the course of being late twice in my 13 years in the NFL, 13 years, you know, playing with the USFL and everything else.
Wow.
I was only late twice for a total of maybe a minute and a half. But to this day, I'm still traumatized. And no one yelled at me. It was just the look you got, and you knew you were never late. You know, it's like you always hear, you know, especially with the Raiders, they didn't care if you showed up drunk or high or whatever. Be here on time and be ready to kick ass. Mm. That's the thing. Just be here. You know, it's the old Lombardi thing. If you're always to practice or to meetings or to the plane or any place, you're always there 15 minutes early. Or you're late.
Like Tom Coughlin used to say, right? Yeah. Tom Coughlin with the Giants, if you're 5 minutes early, you're late.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd show up to the meeting at 5 or 10 till, and Art Shell would just look at me and just. You're just like, come on. I'd be like, what? It's 5 minutes and no one else is even in the room yet. But it was that's how much it's just, there's nothing else that's more important than being there. Then I don't care if you're sick or your wife died or your father or something, you were to practice.
That's you also mentioned Frank Kush, right? Yeah. So you actually cross paths with three really unique individuals: Tom Landry, Frank Kush, and Al Davis. Wow, that's a whole career right there. I mean, three really unique and different personalities, and probably the one that, if you had to say, was the bad one, was Kush.
Oh, big time! Yeah, he was just he didn't realize he was in a man's game. He's used to pushing kids around, and it kind of kills me to hear that, because you hear, you know, I'm watching NCAA basketball and they talk about the kids on the bench and the kids and the kids. No, these are men. They're older than 18, you know.
Yeah.
But Kush, Kush didn't know how to work with men. He was a big runner, and one of the things that drove all the Colts crazy is, no matter what your injury was, I could have sprained my ankle or had a really problem with my knee or whatever it was. After a game on Sunday, we were back at the facility on Mondays, and we had to do a 4-mile path through the woods. It was all marked off where the coaches would be along the way. And one guy at that 2-mile part where he's just checking your name off, you had to run, you'd limp back or you're on crutches or something. Instead of sitting in the training room and getting some treatment or doing something else, get your ass out there. You know, it was so disrespected by everybody. The coaches would say, if you ever want, I'd say, and I'd love to just wear him out. And the coach would say to me, it's like, we'll turn around, look the other way. You know, he was just got nothing really good to say about him. And that's pretty rare for me. I've always tried to find the light in somebody. But he was a nasty man.
Yeah, that comes across in your book. You're a very positive person. Yeah. Hey, you come from a small town in Minnesota, and you start your career in Dallas. What was the culture shock like? And on top of that, now you had money. Life certainly became a lot more exciting for you when you got to Dallas, didn't it?
It's like a juicy magazine you want me to reveal. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I was 21 years old. I went from Minnesota to the world champion America's team, Dallas Cowboys, in the early 80s. The show Dallas was just starting. The oil boom was kind of at its peak. Everybody had big cars. My first car was a Cadillac convertible. Watered off the showroom floor, you know, young knucklehead. But there was a lot of drugs there too, drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I saw a lot of that and did some of that myself. And, it was a crazy time. All by 8 or 10 of my buddies from Northern Iowa came down. We all graduated together. They came down to Dallas. Like I said, the place was booming. So banks were hiring and investment firms were bringing guys on, and which all my buddies were tied in with. And so the motto of the city was work hard and play hard. So from 8 till 5 o'clock, everybody was working like a beast. And then at 5:30, every bar had the most amazing spread of buffet, and it was free. And so you got these young guys like this that can eat a horse. And so you go in there, and everybody in Dallas is in the bars from 7 to about 8 or maybe 9 o'clock, and then you go home. But it was, it was such an amazing, beautiful place to start my career and, and have all my buddies come down from Iowa. And so that's one thing that really kind of kept me from hanging out with a lot of the football players. And I ended up doing that my whole career, even out here with the LA Raiders. Loved them all, but I really loved to get away from it.
Sure.
Play my football. I'm traveling. I'm showering. I'm eating. I'm beating each other up and fighting, but still loving each other. But I gotta go hang out with my other buddies and not talk about football. Or, it was nice to get away from it. And so that's kind of where it all started in Dallas.
Well, you certainly got away from it, and got away from it in some pretty unique ways. But we'll hold off on that. Don't want to spoil everything for everybody.
Okay.
But on the field, you were, in my mind, a part of three very significant events in NFL history. The first came during your rookie season versus the San Francisco 49ers in the NFC Championship game.
Right.
The catch. Tell us about that from your perspective.
Well, right before that, same with my rookie year. Yeah, I'll tell you about that one. But so we're a minute and a half away from going to the Super Bowl. We're in San Francisco. And Dwight Clark Joe Montana is running out of the pocket, and he's coming over towards the Cowboys sidelines. And my buddy and I are looking at each other, just going, holy crap, we're hugging each other, because we know that he's scrambling for his life, Montana is. And he throws this ball that's way too high, and we're just jumping up and down. And these hands come out of nowhere and just and come down with the ball. And it was just, you could just feel your heart just getting torn out. I was a minute and a half away from going to the Super Bowl. So, but then, you know, the stands just exploded. People poured onto the field. And I tell about how kind of terrifying that was, because everybody's grabbing at your mask and your jersey. And there's, you know, 100 people packed around you besides the 30,000 that are pouring onto the field. And so it's just, run for your life, get into the locker room and Super Bowl.
Not the same. Similar, but not the same as what we just watched with Kansas City and San Francisco in the Super Bowl.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another really proud moment that I was talking about, you know, when we were talking about Ditka, and I don't talk about it in the book. I think I do. But my rookie year, and it was just always at the ready. And I think I was trying to make the team at the time. Danny White went onto the field to punt, and he's counting his 10 guys, and there was only 9, and he starts freaking out.
You do cover this in the book.
Oh, I did, yeah. And I'm just sitting there looking at nobody's moving. And I don't know what to do, but they know, I know they need somebody, and they're going to call a timeout. He's just about ready to. He's starting to kind of walk towards the sidelines, and I just come sprinting out, and he's just pointing, guy, get in there. And I came off the field, and Dick, man, just gave me a bear hug. It's like, way to be on top of it. Yeah, so another fun play was, we alluded to it a little bit earlier, up in Minneapolis when...
I wanted to get... That was the next one. The next significant play in your career. And I have to say, I remember watching it. It was during my time in college, and it was your second season in the NFL, 1982, the strike-shortened season.
Yeah.
Only 9 games were played that year, and the Cowboys played in Minnesota, and that was your chance to go back in front of your family and friends. And Tell us about it, how you wound up on the field for that special play. You weren't even supposed to be there.
Yeah, since I was going up there, everybody thinks we get free tickets. I ended up paying for quite a few, but I ended up having about 30 or 35 tickets. And they stuck us in the worst seats, about three rows up, right behind the goalpost. So in the end zone, three rows up. And I'm on all the special teams now. And so we start the second half with a kickoff return, and Timmy Newsome fumbles the ball and kicks it out of bounds on the half-yard line. And so I'm running off the field, and the offensive line coach gets halfway onto the field and says, take right guard, and he's pushing me back out there. The guy that plays right guard was also on the kickoff return team, and his shoe came off, and they're all taped, and he can't get the knot undone. And so I go get into the huddle. But since this was a weird play, they went to a commercial. And so I just sat there and just turned into one big goosebump. You know, like, What am I doing here? I look up, and we're lining up in the end zone. And my family's 15 feet away. You know, I see the pupils of my parents and, you know, my family and all my buddies there. And, you know, sitting there with Tony Dorsett, and I'm the youngest guy in the huddle. Just like, oh, what? This is crazy. You know, and it was, and then we call the play, and it's going right up the middle, right between me and the center and the left guard. So then reality kind of kicked in, like, God, I got to do my best, you know, and I did. And Dorsett took off for 99 and a half yards. And I was like, oh. And then the offensive guard got his shoe back on. So I was in for one play in that game, and it was the longest run in NFL history and went into the Hall of Fame. It was like, why? How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, Steve, your days in Dallas didn't last as long as you probably had hoped.
Yes.
Before we get to historic event number three, I don't know if I've ever asked this question of any of my guests. What is the shock like of being traded, and for you in particular, of being traded from the
America's team.
America's team.
I had just bought a house. I had just closed on a house. I was moving into it. I had a girlfriend. Everything was amazing. We were going into the fourth preseason game, and I was eating, and Tom Landry's walking around the table. And as soon as I got through, he leaned over my shoulder and said, hey, Steve, take a walk with me. And that was the last kind of trading time at that point in, you know, the early 80s. And my heart just dropped, because you knew it was going to be between me and a couple of other guys. And I don't remember if they got traded or not. I think a couple of years later or something like that. But Butch Johnson was one of my teammates I talk about in the book, that he was reading his paper, and he just lowered the paper down and just looked at me and just put his head down.
Now, did you think you were being traded
I was being traded. He said, so I take this two-minute walk with Landry, just walk away from the table, and said, hey, we made a trade for you this morning. You're going to Baltimore this afternoon. This afternoon? What are you talking about? What do you mean this afternoon? He says, yeah, you get a plane at 1 o'clock. And it was 9 o'clock in the morning. I went, what about, you know, changing my mail and grabbing a few things and everything else? I ended up negotiating. I got a few hours later. I think I left at 4 o'clock, but, you know, 4 o'clock to be gone for the season. And went to Baltimore and rented an apartment and brought all the stuff I could bring and made the most of it. But it just ripped my heart out. It really just ripped my heart out, because I kind of was thinking I was going to be around there for a while. I knew they liked me, everything else. It's rough, especially going from there. It would have been a little lighter going to San Francisco or, you know, or Denver or someplace else, but to Baltimore, you know, nothing against Baltimore. It was more or less the stadium, over time.
Yeah, they played back then at Memorial Stadium.
Yeah. And it was called, I don't know, the Crazy House or something. But it was, 65,000 seat stadium. And the most we ever got in there was maybe 25 to maybe 30,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I was listening to one of your guests there, you know, listening to your program. I personally think it was the most brilliant move ever by any businessman, Robert Irsay, leaving in the middle of the night. The city didn't like us. They didn't support us. They didn't like Robert Irsay. They didn't like his family. They didn't like anything to do with us. I write about it in the book. My parents came to a game at the stadium there and had a couple of beers thrown on them. And so Robert Irsay leaves from, you know, losing revenue at all these home games to go into Indianapolis and has a 10-year contract where he's paying $1 rent. $1 rent. And so his money, his, you know, wheelbarrow full of money are pouring in. And then, you know, then he picks up Peyton Manning and, you know, develops a team with all this cash instead of sitting in Baltimore and, you know, going nowhere. Well, so it was, yeah, I think it was brilliant.
Yeah. The ironic thing, and by the way, this is the third significant event that happened, a historic event that happened in your career that I was referring to. Did you, your teammates, did you have any inkling at all that this was going to happen? I mean, yeah, this was a surprise to so many people, almost to virtually everyone.
So when the season was over, I was back at my home in Dallas and just watching, I think it was ESPN at the time, I'm not sure, some sports show. And it showed buses leaving the Baltimore facility. It was like, what? What do you mean we're moving to Indianapolis? Okay. So fly back and get whatever I can out of my apartment, close that thing up, and drove everything over to Indianapolis and made the new home there. And then, you know, tried to renegotiate there after my fourth year of my contract. And it really wasn't going anywhere. And the USFL was courting all the players and offered quite a bit of money for me to go to the Michigan Panthers.
But the day I signed, which went to Oakland.
Yeah, the day, pretty much the day or the day after I signed with the Michigan Panthers, I think it was a Panther contract. They merged together and Oakland absorbed the Panthers. Okay. Yeah. So instead of landing in Michigan and Detroit, wherever it was, I'm out in the Bay Area. And so it was like awesome. And my head coach there, Charlie Sumner, had been the defensive coordinator for the Raiders for like the previous 10 years. We go on and we play in a championship game and lost. The league folded up and Charlie brought myself and Anthony Carter and a few other guys down to Los Angeles to try out for the Raiders. Mm-hmm. And then hung in there till 94 when they moved back up to LA.
What was it like? I mean, from a player's perspective, what was it like? The differences between the USFL and the NFL. I mean, we know the, you know, rules and things like that, but as a player, was it just like being on another team? What were the differences like?
There was a lot of great players. Like, you know, I played against Reggie White and Calvin Bryant, and there was Sam Mills. There was a lot of great players, but probably 2% of the players were great. Where you get to the NFL, and you know, 50% of them are all pro. So it was just the league didn't have the quality of players, but every once in a while you'd have a monster in there, but very rare. Yeah, so it was easy, and I think everybody's dream that's playing that hasn't played in the NFL, like a Reggie White and these other guys, that their whole goal was just to get to the NFL. And that was my hope too, to get back. But, you know, again, I was just staying present and having fun with all my guys. And we had a great year and a lot of great players. And Charlie was a player's coach that we had a lot of fun together. Yeah.
So he takes you from Oakland to Los Angeles to the Raiders. I would say, again, as an outsider, but, you know, I read, I watch. The culture of playing for the Raiders was quite different than playing for any other team. You spent the majority of your career with the Los Angeles Raiders, 6 years. What was it like playing for Al Davis?
Yeah, he was another guy like Ditka. It was hard to satisfy. It was always, he always had an issue with something. Like I always, the way I explained Al Davis is he hates to talk about football. Don't go talk to him about football. But if you're going to talk about football, it better be dominating football and kick ass football and how you're going to crush your opponent. He'll talk about that all day. But if you come up and just talk, you know, shooting the breeze about football, he doesn't want anything to do with you. Very demanding, you know, putting a lot of pressure on the assistant coaches, and then that would reflect back on us. But, you know, it was like you were saying, it was a pretty loose, free, great time. There was a lot of good camaraderie. You know, you'd see some, you know, crazy stuff with guys, you know, just, you know, like we had a stripper come in the locker room. You'd never see that with Dallas or any other team. You know, a stripper, a woman's walking around in our locker room, buck naked, dancing, and nobody's paying attention. We're through with practice. All everybody wants to do is get showered and go home. I felt so bad for this girl. She's dancing around and nobody's paying attention to her. But it was just, you know, just the wacky shenanigans. I have a great story in there about one of our defensive team leaders before a game, trying to just loosen everybody up. We were playing a big game somewhere, and he jumps up on the table in the middle of the dressing room, buck naked, swinging his Johnson around and gyrating to this music. And you're just going like, what in the world is this? This is before a game when you could just see the 49ers or something in Dallas, and they're just, everybody's quiet. They got their headphones on and no one's talking. Yeah, it was just, it was nutty. And then our head coach, Art Schell, steps out and he sees this and he just about falls over. He starts laughing so hard. And this is before the game. But so Jerry, so our guy jumped off the table and it just, we just went about business like it was nothing else. We stopped. There was no talk about it or laughing about it. But it changed the mood to just, we're all in this together and loosen up. Let's go have some fun. And I recall it in the book there. We did, because I just remember how much fun we had coming home from that game. Mm. You know, it was just doing little things like that when team leaders, captains knew something needed to be done. So do something crazy. Yeah.
Was Al ever present? You know, was he present all the time?
All the time.
The practices, the games, and everything. This was, the Raiders were really his life. There was really nothing else.
Live it and sleep it and breathe it. I lived in the same complex with him in Marina Del Rey. And I'd talk to the guards that would let us in and out and, you know, the gate and everything else. And these guys would say, yeah, Al's up till 4 o'clock in the morning every night. They'd, you know, walking around the facility there and they see his lights on or a projector running. Yeah, he'd turn the projector on from like 11 o'clock at night to about 3 o'clock in the morning. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, if he saw Steve Wright stepping with his right foot instead of his left as he's pulling or something like that, he would call the offensive line coach and go, what are you teaching him? Why are you letting Wright get away with this? You know, and just hammer on him. Then the line coach, you have to talk to me. And then when I got a call, thanks to you, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. But Al just pressure. He was a brilliant guy and knew football. And really fortunate. He was always super fair to me. I played hard and gave blood and ligaments and quite a bit of cartilage and everything else. And I think a tooth. And he treated me fair.
How did you, over the course of your career, I guess some people are lucky, you really never suffered, thankfully, a major, major injury. How does that happen? An offensive lineman gets through his entire career. You didn't miss a whole lot of time due to injury.
I didn't. I did blow up my left shoulder in Kansas City. And that was pretty ugly. Got into a big fight there also in another game. everybody's asking me this last week, you know, who you rooting for with the 49ers and the Chiefs. I'll take anybody but the Chiefs. You know, I did just want to see a good game, but you know, every time we would play the Chiefs, we'd get our asses kicked. You know, generally most of the time. But I tore my left shoulder out, and they had to take me to the locker room and lock it back in. And I missed, I think, the last, whatever, half a dozen games of the year. And then Bill Moss and I got into just a waylay, the nose guard for the Chiefs. And I got my mouth just.
Oh, yeah, you talk about that.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Yeah, my gums had been sliced and they were pushed up. So you could see like the roots of my teeth.
Oh.
And so they numbed my mouth up and used tweezers at halftime to pull my gums back down and sew them just barbarically and just wrap it around the teeth. And I got some mouth work done on Monday when we got back to Los Angeles. But yeah, it was, I think I would pass out now. I used to be a little tougher then.
Steve, one of the other things about your career, one of the unique things I think, are the three different types of fan bases that you played in front of. You played in front of the fan base for America's team, the non-interested fan base of the Baltimore Colts at that time, and they right now, the Ravens have a rabid fan base, one of the best fan bases in football.
Right.
And then you played for the lunatic fans of the Raiders Raiders. Talk about that.
That's a good question.
Play on the field.
That's a good question. It was shockingly different. Yeah, Baltimore is kind of like a has been, but Dallas was real sophisticated. You know, champagne and all the the nice things at the concourse there. But yeah, in Los Angeles, it was just nutty. The spikes and the helmets and the diehards, and so it would be a timeout during a game, and we would just stand in the middle of the field. You know, it's 1 o'clock, and we're just looking up. Hey, check out back there. You know, some lady's got her top off, and she's jumping up and down, and then you look a few rows away from her, and guys are just bloodying each other, just pounding each other. And how you'd see a line, it looked like a centipede of 25 cops running down wearing helmets and everything else. And they would bash them and drag them onto the field and along the side so they could get them out of the stadium. And it's just like, yeah, it was a kind of a crazy nut house, but they sure loved us.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
Hey, so if I followed the statistics correctly, 1990 and 1991, you started every single game for the Raiders. In that sense, you finally made it.
Yeah.
Did you approach your career differently as far as maturity, off the field antics, taking care of your body? How did all of that differ at that point in your career after your first few years in Dallas? Where, if you read the book, it was one heck of a party down there.
Yeah. No, great question, Warren. Really excellent question. So back then, with Dallas, the heaviest lineman was 275. And you were fined if you were over 275 or 280.
What?
Yeah.
What?
2 years later, in 1983, the Hogs came into being with the Washington Redskins.
Mm.
So everybody started going to a bigger human up on the line. They wanted bigger offensive line. I went in my rookie year. I was no more than 260 pounds playing on the offensive line. So we would more position block. But then as I got older and I was out here and my off seasons are in I just spend them at Gold's Gym in Venice and just packing. You know, herds of cattle away, stuffing myself with protein and shakes and lifting nonstop. So my weight got up to 290 and I finally hit 300. And it was, it was just less fat than I have now. I was in just rocket shape. So my body was finally where it really needed to be. And I had the experience in my head how to you know, play the game. And yeah, so it was just, I really kind of settled in. That was definitely, it was a good call by you. It was, yeah, it was a peak of my career. Yeah. Just mentally, emotionally, physically, you know, knowing that I was really secure there was super helpful. Mm-hmm. And just spending a ton of time at the facility running and lifting and watching film differently. Harder, and I'm finally in there with four other guys, and we're, you know, Max Montoya was my guard. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just did everything together and really relied on each other, and I was dependent on him as he was on for me. And so it was a great functioning unit that, you know, not just me, but it took all of us.
Mm-hmm. I do have to ask this question. This is part of, I guess, the maturity question. You did experience a life-changing event during your years with Los Angeles. You got a particular phone call from an old flame. I think her name was Lori. Would you mind sharing that with us and how that changed your life and perhaps your perspective on your career?
Sure. Yeah, I was in the peak of my career and sleeping around a little bit too much and sometimes not using protection. And I got a call from a friend in Pittsburgh, said she was pregnant. And it, you know, it just threw my whole world upside down. Did the paternity test, it's mine. Tried to finish up. Well, I did. I finished up my season, and then went out to Pittsburgh and really kind of bonded with the little guy, and Lori and her parents, and kind of just got to know everybody. And you know, it was pretty rough. She was seeing a guy at the time, and he's around, and it was super awkward, but I think over time, well, I know over time, not too long, a couple of years, they knew my heart. And I was a good guy, just, you know, made a rough mistake. And, but my son now he's 34 and, great kid, great relationship. He's in Salt Lake and actually I'm going to see him in the middle of April or something. Yeah. He was just out here a couple of months ago surfing and yeah, it was a rough time, but it's, you know, like we were just talking earlier about the peak of my career, I was kind of getting it all together. And then that definitely threw a wrench in things, but it also altered my life behavior, I think is what you're alluding to. Yeah. Just kind of stopped, you know, going to the bars and rather get a good night's sleep and, you know, cherish what I have and don't screw things up. And, you know, it takes forever develop who I am in everybody else's eyes, and takes you 2 minutes to screw it up. So
sure.
I came from a really solid family, like I started off saying, and they were always very supportive of, you know, the situation that, you know, I got myself into. And it was some awkward times, but you know, it was reality, and so we got through it.
Mm-hmm. You did bring him out to L.A., and I don't think Al Davis appreciated seeing him running around on the field, though.
Yeah, that was actually in Pittsburgh. That was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. I got him onto the field in Pittsburgh, and he's only about 6 years old. And I ended up talking to our punter for a while as soon as I came out, and just got distracted with our conversation and forgot about my son. And I hear this, get off the field. And it was Al Davis yelling. So just bloody murder. I look over and my son is running right through the middle of drills, through the quarterback drills and, you know, going after balls that wide receivers are trying to catch. And I was like, ah. He ran back and everything was fine. And Al was cool with it. But that was a memorable, fun time.
Mm. Why did you retire after the 1992 season?
I was fortunate to see an opportunity when I was in Palm Springs. There was mist blowing above the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of a quick story, but I ended up bringing it back and asked Art Shell if I could try putting this above our bench and blow some fans and have this cool mist come down. And I got it out there and everybody loved it. Things just crazily took off from there. Some people in the stands wanted to know what it was. And it wasn't anything that I invented. I just found another opportunity for it, another place I could use it instead of a restaurant. So I was cooling off horses at Hollywood Park, where SoFi Stadium is now. They tore out Hollywood Park and built this SoFi Stadium. But then it just turned into restaurants and everything else. And the team was getting ready to move up to Oakland. It was actually, I retired in 94. Because I was out for a year with injuries. And so when the team was going to move up to Oakland, I could have gone up there with them and possibly struggled through another year, but end up in Oakland or stay down in Los Angeles and see if I can make something of this misting business. I incorporated a company called Cloudburst and ended up getting it in all kinds of places. I was in 1,500 Home Depots, Lowe's, and Targets, and Costco's. And then I landed in the 1996 Summer Olympics.
And that's a great story because it really does show the kind of person who you are, Steve.
Thank you.
A shoe salesman comes to your locker room and nobody really pays attention to this guy. But you gave him the time of day.
Right.
And things have a way of paying back. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's karma. It's doing something nice for somebody else without looking for a return. And I wasn't trying to be Mr. Goody Two Shoes or anything, but I just saw this shoe salesman, and we were all wearing Converse and Nike and Adidas or whatever. I was wearing Converse, and this guy was just trying to sell this brand new shoe and hope somebody would give it a go.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Dude, give me a pair of 16s." And so I wore him in the game. He became a hero in his company. They just, wow, you got some shoes in an NFL game with the Raiders.
Wow.
And so he was just a hero. And so then 4 years after that is the 1996 Summer Olympics. And I do my little dog and pony show with my partner, you know, what we can do. And we're going up against Raytheon and GE. And these monsters that can do anything. And it's just my partner and I. We got this little business in Venice, California. And I haven't even cooled a town fair. And I get a call. And this guy said, "Hey, you got the Olympics. Congratulations." And I said, "No way. What are you talking about?" He goes, "You don't remember me, do you? My name is John Ariano." John Ariano, I think was his name. He said, "You helped me 4 years ago become a hero in my company by taking my shoe on when nobody else would. Everybody was dicks to me except for you."
And wow.
He goes, "Now it's your..." It gives me goosebumps. He goes, "Now it's your turn. I believe in you. Make us proud." And
wow.
We did a great job. We were working 20 hours a day. Yeah, but it was easy 20 hours. It was so pumped. We had 180 $3,500 misting fans all over the Olympics. And yeah, it was quite an opportunity, but it was just treating people right. And there's some other stories in the book too, of just, you know, we're all alike and, you know,
Steve, you know, there is so much more that we can cover. Your life off the field, I like to think, is the type of stuff that Hollywood dreams about, from your crazy partying days to making it big with your company Cloudburst, mm-hmm. to the adventures that you experienced after your days in football, including an appearance on Survivor.
Yeah.
So let's wind up our discussion today with that. Now, what was it like being on Survivor, and without risking any legal ramifications.
Right.
What can you tell us?
Let's see. I was down at Fox Studio. I go down there once or twice a year to see Howie and hang out in the green room. And there's other celebrities there and, you know, all rubbing elbows and having fun and yucking it up. And Jimmy Johnson, the coach, had been on Survivor the year before. So he ended up having the casting director there. And they asked if I wanted to give it a shot, that the finals were coming to Los Angeles in a few weeks. Do you want to give it a go? And I said, sure. You know, that's part of what I really try to express in my book is when a door cracks open, charge through it, because that's going to close. Mm-hmm. You'll never have that opportunity again. Like, if I would have thought about it and said, let me call you tomorrow, I'm sure I wouldn't have gotten a hold of them, you know, and I would have, dang it, you know. My thing is never end your life with a coulda, woulda, shoulda. Go for it. You know, I might run into a wall or might not make the Survivor season or big mm-hmm. deal, but just go for it. I learned that from Tony Robbins walking on his burning coals.
Yeah,
just you go, talk about go that too. and keep moving. So I really try to preach that with everybody. But so next thing I know, I ended up in Nicaragua and starved for the next 30. I was in the game for 31 days. I was the last survivor in my group. It was 2010. It was Redemption Island, 2010.
Uh-huh.
I ended up losing 33 pounds in 31 days.
Wow.
Just starving. And then I got back here to the States, and I was going to go see my parents. And my front tooth was bugging me. So I went to the dentist, and he took an x-ray and said, holy crap. He says, we're pulling that thing right now. My front tooth. what are you going to pull my front tooth? And he goes, there is more bacteria in there. This kills people in third world countries.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, he pulled that thing out, and it stunk so bad. Sorry, to be nasty, but I hadn't brushed my teeth in over 30 days. The way I describe it is, this is your toothbrush. This is your toilet paper. You don't have anything. The show is 100% real. If somebody's starving, they're starving. If someone's an ugly crazy man, they're an ugly crazy man. It's not an act.
Wow.
It's a brutal time. They asked if I wanted to come back a couple years later, and I hung up so fast. No thanks. No thanks. Oh, so then I ended up going over to Arizona, and I saw my parents. I walk in, and I look like Skeletor. I'm just skin and bones and missing a front tooth. My parents said, you got to get out of Los Angeles, son.
Wow. That's awesome. Hey, man, your book, Aggressively Human, again, it's really entertaining, fun to read. And yep, there it is. I was really intrigued when you first reached out. Aggressively Human. I was wondering why such a title. Well, after reading the book, it's apparent why such a title. So why write it, and where can people get a copy of it?
They can get a copy of it on Amazon. You can go, if you go to writeauthor.com, my website, there'll be a hot link to Amazon, or you can DM me. And I'll send you out a personalized book with however you want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and then why write it, did you say?
Yeah, yeah.
It was just like you've been saying. I've got a lot of life lessons. And this isn't a you should book or trying to teach anybody anything. It's just how one guy did it. And happy I did it this way. Just learning through my growth. And as I started to write, it kind of took a form of its own, became the Aggressively Human. The theme kind of started to fall into place of having compassion and empathy that I grew up with my parents, and, just seeing how other people, you know, got the short end of the stick. And, it just always moved my heart to try to, you know, do what I can. Just all people, you know, everybody dealing with something. And so, come with a lot of grace and, and listen and be compassionate and full of empathy, but also too, once in a while, the aggressiveness is needed. You see that a lot in just the world today, guys and women and everything. They're either too passive or too aggressive. Mm-hmm. It can be about vaccines, or it can be about, you know, Palestine and Israel, or, you know, whatever it is, you know, there's just, everybody's just like this, or they're just sitting mm-hmm. and, mm-hmm. and being a pushover. Mm-hmm. And, so it was just a really enjoyable time writing the book. One of the most enjoyable times I've ever had writing. It took us about 8 months. Mm-hmm. I did it with my wife, and she helped pull the whole thing together. I wrote all the stories, and then she really put some magic to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was such a great time to sit out on my patio and looking out at the ocean and writing a, you know, take me 3 hours to write a paragraph, or, you know, 3 hours to write 5 pages, and, mm-hmm. and then we get together every night and, you know, read to each other and edit, and yeah, it's just an awesome experience. I highly recommend it to everybody. It's just, once you don't try to do it all at once, just take the steps, just get started, and then all of a sudden that third grade story, you remember that, and then I get that picture of me in seventh grade playing, you know, basketball, and what went on there, and it just kind of starts to develop, and pretty soon you got a few hundred pages of copy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, it's terrific. And thank you to your wife, Lizzie, for helping you write that, because it really is a fun read. Aggressively Human. I encourage everybody to get a copy. You won't be disappointed, Steve. Thank you so much for spending so much time with me on Sports Forgotten Heroes. This has been a lot of fun.
Warren, I really enjoyed it. You did a great job. You did a lot of research, asked them great questions, and you know, questions that haven't been asked before, you know, the crowds, and did a great job, and I really appreciate it.
You got it, man. Anytime.
Hey, if you're looking for a very entertaining book to read and you are a fan of football, I encourage you to pick up a copy of Aggressively Human. While we covered the surface of Steve's career on the field, there is so much more he touches upon. Playing for Art Shell, lining up against Lawrence Taylor, what life was like in the locker room, and of course his life off the field, parties, women, Playboy bunnies, and the amazing transformation his life has taken since those days so long ago. You won't be disappointed. Thanks again to Steve for stopping by, and I look forward to seeing all of you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.